Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon. We'll talk with programmer Shay Wilson about Thursday's workshop, Think Like a Computer. We'll talk with former Juno resident Britt Arneson about her new CD. And we'll find out about Judge James Wickersham's Wednesday birthday celebration. And we'll find out if you can play the marimba with guest Betsy Sims. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more. We're next live on KTOO, repeated at 4 o'clock at KRNN. And available online via KTOO.org. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government has formally apologized for the forced relocation of Dene people in Manitoba. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
In 1956, the Government of Canada forced about 250 Saisi Dene to leave Duck Lake, Manitoba, and resettle to a barren area near Churchill, mainly because officials believed that Dene were causing a steep decline in the caribou herd. That was later proven to be untrue. But in their new home, the Dene found that food was scarce and housing was inadequate. Many were forced to scavenge the local dump for scraps. Others were assaulted by the residents of Churchill. When the Manitoba government apologized for its role in the relocation, it acknowledged that about a third of the Saisi died as a result of poverty, racism, and violence. Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister Carolyn Bennett could not hold back the tears when she made the apology.
We are sorry. 60 years ago, the government of Canada made a tragic and fatal decision that continues to impact all Saisi Dene First Nation members to this day.
The Saisi Dene eventually moved back to their traditional territory in 1973. Along with the apology comes a $33 million settlement package. It's aimed at economic development. But Saisi elders who lived during the resettlement say 60 years is a long time to wait for the government to step up and admit what was done to them was wrong. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Demonstrations took place over the weekend in cities across the U.S. to show support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe of North Dakota, which is opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline project. People marched in Denver, Colorado, Omaha, Nebraska, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the Twin Cities, Minnesota, saying they stand with Standing Rock. The tribe and those in opposition of the pipeline say it's a threat to water. Meanwhile, on Friday, North Dakota's governor authorized an emergency declaration, making available additional state resources to manage public safety at a protest camp near Cannonball, which police estimated last week to be more than 1,500 people. Demonstrators at the camp maintain their actions are nonviolent. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe called the governor's action unfortunate, adding that the tribe looks at the situation as an opportunity to work together. An Alaska Native publisher recently bought the Homer Tribune on the Kenai Peninsula and hopes the paper will provide more coverage of Native communities. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
Jason Evans says although he and his wife own two other newspapers, they were not in the market for a new one.
We do have some talented staff that live in Homer, and so it was a natural to pick up the Homer Tribune and start publishing it as well.
Evans, along with his wife, Kiana Peacock, owns Alaska Media LLC, the company that recently bought the Homer Tribune. The company already publishes two other weekly community newspapers, the Arctic Sounder and the Bristol Bay Times Dutch Harbor Fisherman. The Tribune stopped publishing its paper edition on June 8th and went to a web-only version. Shortly thereafter, Evans and Peacock picked the paper up. Evans says the Tribune will continue its online version along with a printed edition.
You know, it's something that people can take with them to their camps. They can cut out photos and hang them on the refrigerator.
Evans is Alaska Native, Inupiaq, originally from Nome. He says highlighting Alaska Native voices in rural parts of the state is important to the company. He hopes the Tribune will dedicate more coverage to the Native communities on the southern Kenai Peninsula. I'm Daisha Eaton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the 3rd Annual Southwest Native American Veterans Association September 22nd through the 24th. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling in the studio with our producer, Jeff Brown. Looking at this week's weather, 90% chance of rain through tomorrow night, decreasing to 60% through Wednesday, and then dropping down to 40% on Thursday with even a chance of sun on Friday. So kind of peaking out the rain by tomorrow night and then decreasing chances with better weather, we hope, for the weekend. Welcome aboard our first guest this afternoon on Juneau Afternoon are Shay Wilson and Heidi Clemens. Shay is a computer programmer and Heidi Clemens is one of the people who helps with outreach for the Juneau Public Libraries. Glad to have you here. We were chatting a little bit before the show and Shay was telling me, and we were agreeing this was probably ancient history in computer time, that when he was a kid in the mid-80s, he was exposed to computer programming at about age 8, and it really got him thinking as an adult about why it's not more of a practice that we consider part of youth literacy. First, I want to know, Shay, how did you become exposed to programming as a little kid of 8 years old?
I was very lucky. My father noticed that I was interested in sciencey things, and he purchased me a computer for Christmas one year.
And what year would that have been?
It would have been around 85.
So that's ancient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at that time, you had a DOS prompt, and so to get around it, you did a lot of Word just commands to navigate the computer.
And that was something that hooked you then as a kid?
Yeah, just having computers do work for you and talking to computers, it's fascinating.
And talk a little bit about what you now do as an adult.
I work for the legislature doing programming I run some of the programs that help create bills and do the laws.
How do you program? I am a user of computers, of course. It's hard not to be in today's world. But what is the actual act of programming?
The act of programming is really just writing down sentences that tell the computer what to do. And then there's some way of activating those lines of instruction. So that it's pretty straightforward. It's just lines of instruction, but they have to be formulated so that the computer can understand them, because they don't understand regular words.
They're only a machine.
Yeah.
So talk about how you've connected with the library and this workshop that is going to be offered for youth this week.
So I've been thinking for a long time about helping primary-aged, elementary-aged students get into computers and coding. And so I approached the library and got in contact with their outreach librarians who helped me set up this program.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that, Heidi?
Yeah.
Why would the library be interested in offering this? Do you see it as a form of literacy?
Absolutely. We were really, really excited, and we're so lucky that Shay wants to work with us, because this is something we've been wanting to do for a while. We've done the Hour of Code that some people might be familiar with. We've done programs like that in the past, but this is something, a reoccurring program with computer coding for kids is something we've really been wanting to do, but just figuring out, for those of us who don't speak computer, how to facilitate that and make sure we have someone with the expertise to answer those questions that kids are going to have, because that's how they learn. And so this is, as Shay was kind of saying a little bit, that this is something that is really important, digital literacy for children and for the future, and having those people with those skills early on like Shay did is really important for legislature, for making apps, for all sorts of things that kids can grow up and become passionate about. So the library obviously is just a free resource here in the community. We're all about being an open door to learning and exploration and trying new things. And so this is just a great opportunity for anyone who either hasn't done anything with coding before, just wants an introduction to figure out what we're even talking about right now, or people who maybe have participated in Hour of Code or things like that, it will be an introduction.
Heidi, are you targeting a particular age group?
We are. We're targeting ages 8 and up. That's pretty flexible, though. We even encourage curious adults who maybe want to learn more about coding to figure out what this is all about. It's definitely open. And so the first one is this Thursday at the Valley Library, 6:30 p.m. to 7:30. We'll be out there. And as I said, it's a reoccurring thing. So it's going to be the fourth Thursday of every month. So if you can't make it out this Thursday, I guess the next date would be September 22nd. Just kind of keep an eye on the library calendar. We'll be doing this in the Valley each month.
So, Shay, you mentioned that as a boy you were kind of science-y. I think that was the word you used. It seems a little bit counterintuitive to imagine an 8-year-old boy. I have an 8-year-old nephew. And to think about him, in spite of how bright he is, to what I would imagine would require sitting still for long enough to create those sentences, to have a computer know what to do next. Help me understand if I'm wrong in that concept.
I think you'd be surprised at how quickly you can go from writing things to seeing immediate results on your screen. This lesson is going to be unplugged. It's not going to be on the computers. We're going to be working with our hands. We hope to transition to more computer work, and I think to speak to your point, though, the immediacy is actually really gratifying. You write a couple of sentences and you can get some amazing things to happen.
So will they be using some kind of prototype then to get that cycle of response going?
This one's about data structures, so we're going to be using physical objects and sorting them like a computer would.
You have a book in your hand. Is this a book that you wrote for kids? Tell me about this.
I certainly didn't write it. Shortly after I contacted the library, I went and found a book that is kind of instructions for teaching primary age students coding and computer concepts. So I've been carrying it around with me, trying to absorb the material, because that's what I'm doing to kind of make sure I'm targeting the right age. And I certainly don't want to go over anybody's heads and make them feel intimidated by computers, because that I think is actually the large objection for adults, is they feel intimidated by computers, and they really shouldn't.
One of the things I've noticed in the news about the tech world is the very small representation of females in this field, particularly in coding. Why do you think that is, Shay?
I think we were just talking about intimidation. I think that certainly can happen. Working with me, I have a team of three programmers, and two-thirds of them are female. So I see a lot of female coders. But in technology in general, I think people can get the opinion it's not for them. And I think that's one thing I'm hoping to solve, is I think that working with computers and talking to computers is for everyone.
When you describe this, writing the language or writing the sentences, is it actually in a sentence like I might read, or is it in a different kind of language that the learners need to learn?
You can read it. It's using really simple words in short sentences to be very unambiguous. You use like if this, then do this.
So those that true logical structure.
Yeah, and so you'll use that, or you'll say, while this condition is true, do this set of code. And so you can read down a line of code, and it is English. It may be a little simple for people to read because it's short words and it's meant to be very unambiguous.
So Heidi, how are you marketing this? How are you letting kids know that writing code is fun?
Well, excellent question. I was just thinking on that topic of, is this for girls and boys? It's for, yeah, absolutely for everyone. We want everyone to come out. So we've kind of put the word out to a few different groups in the community that we thought would be interested, Girl Scouts and things like that. And we think everything at the library that happens is fun. Maybe we're a little biased, but we, specifically for this unplugged one, we're not even, like Shay said, we're not even going to sit down on computers right away. We're going to have a small group activity that we're doing and working together and seeing how this communicating with computers works. And the title of the program is Think Like a Computer, which we're hoping at least is intriguing to some people. Like, what does it mean to think like a computer? So yeah, this is the first of many in a series. So we're going to see who's interested and who wants to come out and try this out and hope that they can make it out each month.
Can folks drop in, or do they need to pre-register?
They do not need to pre-register.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. We're talking with Heidi Clemens and with Shay Wilson about a workshop targeting kids who are about 8 to 12 this Thursday, 6:30 to 7:30 at the Valley Library. And the intent is that this will be an ongoing series for kids about how to program computers every fourth Thursday. So, Shay, just to wrap up, will there be, I hesitate to call it homework, but activities or practices that the youth can do in the interim between these fourth Thursday meetings?
There'll be exercises that we're doing in the meeting, but I haven't even pondered stuff outside. If we go to coding computers, I hope to give people ideas of where they can take it after class, because that's really the plan. I don't want it to end. Have a beginning and end. I want this to be a start of something new for them to do.
And does the kid who wants to participate need to have any special skills?
No. One of the reasons it was aged 8 was for reading comprehension, but I think this particular one is fairly low on reading. So,
should be accessible to pretty much any kid then in that age group.
Yep, and yeah. I think some adults could have some fun too.
So it's not closed to the grown-ups.
Nope.
Right.
Is there a number folks can call, Heidi, for more information about the Think Like a Computer workshop?
Sure. They can call the main Juneau Public Libraries line, 586-5249, and they can always find more info at juneau.org/library. Juneau Public Libraries also has a Facebook page where we make sure we're putting these announcements out regularly. So all of those places.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 22nd of August, 2016. It's the birthday of the writer who suggested they put on her tombstone, wherever she went, including here, it was against her better judgment. Dorothy Parker, born Long Branch, New Jersey, 1893, went to a Catholic elementary school, though she was Jewish, asked to leave after she referred to the Immaculate Conception as spontaneous combustion. She became a theater critic at Vanity Fair, wrote book reviews for The New Yorker and short stories and poems, died in 1967, and bequeathed her entire estate to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It's the birthday of the novelist Annie Proulx, born 1935, Norwich, Connecticut, author of The Shipping News, which won the Pulitzer Prize when it came out in 1993. Her family came from Quebec down to Connecticut, went to college briefly, left to get married. She had children, later went back to college, but decided she wasn't fit for the academic life. She said, "I'm not a person who works well with others, having to get along with people you don't respect very much, having to deal with a bureaucracy, just the whole weight of idiots turned me off." She got divorced. She raised three sons as a single mother. She earned money by writing how-to books and then short stories about rural life, many of them involving hunting and fishing. She was 56 when her first novel came out, Postcards. She was living in Newfoundland at the time and working on her second novel, The Shipping News, about a sad man who moves to a little fishing village in Newfoundland. Her latest novel, which took her 10 years to write, is Barkskins, 700 pages about deforestation and capitalism. Annie Proulx, who said you should write because you love the shape of stories and sentences and the creation of different worlds on a page. Writing comes from reading, and reading is the finest teacher of how to write. And it's the birthday of the science fiction and fantasy writer Ray Bradbury, born Waukegan, Illinois, 1920, grew up reading Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. He started writing when he was 12 years old back in 1932 and said that he wrote every single day of his life from then on, author of The Martian Chronicles, Fahrenheit 451, Farewell Summer. Ray Bradbury, who said, "I don't try to describe the future, I try to prevent it." He said, "Go to the edge of the cliff and jump off, build your wings on the way down." Here's a poem for today by Lewis Simpson, "At the Church Door." I didn't stay for the closing hymns and prayers. I felt out of sorts, so I left. Someone was before me at the door, a child gazing at a spot on her wrist. She said, "Can you help me?" "What is it?" "A ladybug," she said. So I opened the door, and she said it jumped off. We stood looking around. "It'll be all right," I said. She went in, and I left, taking care where I stepped. At the Church Door, a poem by Lewis Simpson from The Owner of the House, published by Boa Editions, Limited, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Well, we'd like to welcome former Juneau resident Britt Arneson to our program this afternoon. Good afternoon, Britt. You are in Missoula, is that right?
That's right. Hi, Lori.
Glad to have you with us. So I'm reading your charming handwritten letter to the station, and Jeff and I were marveling that it's not often that we receive a handwritten letter from anybody, and it was great to hear from you. You mentioned that you have just completed your sixth CD of music, and that you're in at least two bands in Missoula, both of which sound like they have bluegrass flavor. Tell us about what you're doing, Britt.
I'm just having a wonderful time down here. There's a lot of people to collaborate with. Of course, I'm a little bit homesick because nothing is quite like Juneau. But there's wonderful musical community here, and I got bit by the bluegrass bug several years ago, and I just had to come be a part of a bigger scene. So I moved down here to join up with the bands, and the Acousticals, of which the new CD is from, is my favorite band that I'm in because we play all original material. And I've been writing songs for 20 years, and so we do my songs, and we do songs that are written by the other two members of the band. And I play upright bass, I play guitar, and I play mandola and mandolin. And I sing, and it's a wonderful thing. I'm glad to be able to share the music with you.
So you have your sixth CD out. Is that a separate CD from the new one by the Acousticals?
The Acoustical CD is my sixth. I have two CDs that I released as 907 Brit were my first two, and then I released three under the band Britney, and then this is the sixth by the Acousticals. And the Acousticals have been around for a long time, but I just joined the band in the last couple of years.
I'm going to say they sounded familiar, and I see that you are credited with playing bass and doing the vocals on this album, and it sounds wonderful. Why bluegrass, Britt?
I just really like it. I remember the first time I heard it, it just spoke to me, and it's just so hard to explain, but I've tried to get into other kinds of music. I've tried very hard, and bluegrass is definitely the music of my heart. It definitely is.
Bluegrass seems to be gaining attention on more popular levels as well. With, for example, Nora Jane Struthers, I believe her album won a Grammy a couple years ago. How would you describe bluegrass is changing as it broadens its appeal?
Well, a lot of what we do in the Acousticals can be considered kind of modern. We're breaking the mold by writing our own material. Traditionally, bluegrass has been the kind of genre where you're supposed to stick with standards. And it's been a fun challenge to write songs that are brand new but sound like standards. I've been enjoying doing that. Also, here in Missoula, there's a lot of activity around new folk where maybe they take what might seem like bluegrass instrumentation and then change the backbeat, like put a dance beat behind it. Normal bluegrass, it just has kind of a plodding rhythm that is very straight and same and steady, and a lot of people are mixing that up. I personally am on the more traditional end of the spectrum. I really love playing old style bluegrass, and one of the bands I play in, that's all we do. We just do kind of traditional style bluegrass, and we play at parties and fun functions, and that's really fun. And then when I want to do something exciting and creative and interesting and different and innovative, that's when the original material. And just the fact that it's a brand new song makes it kind of new. But there's a lot of ways to take an old genre and make it new. People are adding new instruments to it, playing it in different kind of venues. And I'm really definitely into very traditional kinds of bluegrass. So our new record is traditional in its sound, even though all the songs are brand new.
I'm wondering if you're able to make a living as a musician. Are you able to do this full time?
Yeah, I wasn't able to in Alaska, so that's part of why I had to come down here. But here in western Montana, there's a really wonderful scene, lots of work. I have been making my living professionally as a musician for 5 years now down here. And it's possible to do that here because every night there's a different small town I can drive to. I typically, you know, will drive an hour away to a different town to have a gig, and you just can't do that in Alaska. There's not another town an hour away that you can just drive to, but here, every small town has a brewery, a bar, a restaurant, and they all have music. It's not just something that you find occasionally. There's actually really a lot of support financially for live music down here, and there's a lot of competition for the jobs. If you're willing to work really hard and get really good, you can get the jobs. So that's what I've been focused on doing.
And I see you're in two groups. So you mentioned the Acousticals, and you're also in a group called Britchie. We're looking at their album, Two Lane Highway. What's the difference between these two groups?
Well, Britchie is actually in both groups, as am I. So basically, we call it the Acousticals when we have more than just the two of us. And when we play just the two of us, which is actually what we're doing tonight at a restaurant here in town, it's all original material, and we switch instruments up a lot. I play guitar and mandola in that group, and then we sometimes have a larger event, and we can scale it up and add more personnel. I'm also in a band called Pine Grass that plays traditional bluegrass material. And then I'm in one other band called the Triple Tree String Band that plays kind of modern folk and just a lot of variety. I kind of anymore don't worry so much about what the band is called. I'm just trying to fill the calendar.
Absolutely. I see Britchie is Richie Reinhold and Britt Arneson, and thus the name Richie. So you, if I calculate this correctly, you're in four bands at least, Britt.
Yes, and that doesn't count when I fill in for other bands or if I play by myself, which I still do quite a bit. For the longest time, I played a solo singer-songwriter career, and I've just kind of really come to enjoy playing with other people.
And how do you market your work?
You know, it's very difficult, but as it turns out, I mailed you guys a letter, and you actually called me. So I think sometimes these old-school ways of trying to get in touch with people have really been working for me. I'm kind of stuck in 2008 when it comes to computers. I'm just really far behind the times online, and I don't have a lot of steam and stamina for online marketing anymore. I just don't have the energy for it. And so I'm trying to just win over people's hearts and minds one-on-one, sending them letters, making phone calls, trying to show up with my guitar at places, and trying excellence, because I've noticed when we're really nailing it, when we do a great job, it speaks for itself, and we don't have to tell people that it's good because they can hear it.
Where can people
find...
So that's
what I'm striving for.
Where can people find your music, Britt? I know you have a website. It's 907Brit, and that's with two T's, so 907Brit.com. Are there other websites where the music is downloadable from the various groups with which you perform?
That's the best place to get it because I have it all collated there. So if you just go to 907Brit.com, I have a tab for each of the bands that actually has material online. And then I'm on Facebook, and anybody can friend me. I'm not on there all the time. I don't have a lot of time to check it, but you're welcome to friend me on Facebook. Britt Arneson, Arneson, is my name. And I'm out there as 907Brit on the web, and you're all welcome to find me and communicate with me.
And what would you like to say to your pals still in Juneau while you have a chance to do that?
Well, I was listening to the quote right before from Ray Bradbury about build your wings on the way down. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you remember, but I was actually in an English class that you taught when I was in high school.
Too.
I wish that back then that I would have just gone straight into music, but instead I thought that it would be better to have a so-called real career first, and I lost six good years. So I would say to anybody to just dive into your dream first and then worry about it later. That's what I would say. I mean, I don't regret having a career for 6 years, but if I would have gone straight into music, then I would have gotten a little farther by the time I'm at where I am now.
Well, so. It's such a pleasure to talk with you, Britt. We wish you well. I'll check out some of your music. I have become a bluegrass aficionado myself. We're going to listen to Man on My Moon. Britt, take good care.
Thank you very much.
For you, oh, the first.
On My Moon by former resident Britt Arneson from the album Two Lane Highway. You can find her work at 907Britt, that's with two T's, .com. Continuing on a Juno afternoon, I'm Lori Scandling in the studio with our producer, Jeff Brown. Our next guest by telephone as well is Mary Kay Haven. She's a volunteer with the House of Wickersham, which this week on Wednesday will be celebrating Judge James Wickersham's birthday up at that beautiful historic home up on Chicken Ridge. Welcome, Mary Kay. Glad to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Yes.
So I have to ask, how old would the judge be were he to join the birthday party this Wednesday?
159. He was born in 1857.
Well, he was certainly a towering figure. I know that. I volunteered up at the museum, gosh, many, many years ago. Tell us what the public ought to remember most about Judge James Wickersham. Certainly, he was our representative in Congress before Alaska became a state, but he also did some other amazing things. Give us an outline.
He did. He was a federal district judge from 1900 to 1909. He was appointed by President McKinley, and his territory was 300,000 square miles, which went from the Canadian border all the way to the Aleutian Islands. He did that from 1900 to 1909, and then he ran for Congress, and he was Alaska's first delegate to Congress. But while he was a judge, he climbed Mount McKinley. He was in the first expedition to even attempt to climb Mount McKinley, and they went up the west side because there were no maps at the time and ran into what is now called the Wickersham Wall, which is a very steep cliff on the west side of the mountain. That prevented them from making it all the way to the summit, but they went farther than anybody else had ever been in 1903. And then when he was in Congress, he was unable to vote because Alaska was not a state, but he could introduce bills. So he introduced bills to make McKinley a national park and to finance both the Alaska Railroad and the Alaska University System, home rule so Alaskans could vote, and he introduced the first legislation for statehood. So he was very influential in the start of Alaska.
And how long did he serve as the states, or now the states, then just a territory? How long did he serve as Alaska's delegate in Congress?
He served seven terms, and it was between 1909 and 1933. They were not consecutive terms. He served from 1909 to 1921, I think, and then in 1933.
So when did he live in the house that is up on 7th Street?
He moved here in 1928, and he lived here until his death in 1939. His first wife, Debbie, had died of tuberculosis in 1926, and then in 1928 he married Grace Bishop, and she was a widowed teacher who lived here in Juneau, and they bought the House of Wickersham together.
And did he ever have any surviving descendants, children?
He and Debbie had three sons, and only the oldest lived to adulthood. That was Darrell. And Darrell went to Annapolis in 1900, the year they came to Alaska. He married, had a career as a Navy officer, but had no children. And the two younger boys died in childhood, so they had no direct descendants. Eventually, Grace Wickersham's niece, Ruth Allman, inherited the house. And she had it open until 1984. You'll probably remember she's the one that made the flaming sourdough waffles.
Oh, yes. I worked with Ruth up there.
Ooh, good. Yeah, she must have been quite the character.
She certainly was. Absolutely. So I'm interested when the house reopened, because it wasn't opened for a while there. What happened?
Right. Well, the state bought the house in 1984, and they spent several years in restoration, a lot of work to the foundation. It's on the National Register of Historic Homes, so there's limits to what they can do to modify it, but mostly just to restore it to its original beauty. And then off and on, it's been closed. I've been the volunteer here for the past three summers, and I think several years before that it was open. And I think that's why people in Juneau were confused about when we're open. We are open for tours mid-May through mid-September, Sunday through Thursday, 10 to 5. and they were closed on Friday and Saturday. So I'm not really sure which years it was closed, but I know it's been open at least for the last 5 years.
And it is a lovely home with many of his belongings in it, as I recall.
It does. It has those locked moose antlers that he found. He found two moose that had been fighting, and they got their antlers locked, and they died. And then he used the locked antlers as a hat rack in his law office.
Now, he was an author as well.
He was. He wrote Old Yukon, which is his memoirs. He kept a diary the entire 39 years he lived in Alaska, and wrote Old Yukon for that. Tells about the trials that he held, and about traveling by steamship, sled dogs, and snowshoe from place to place. He was even invited to go to Nome to overturn some decisions of a judge that was unscrupulous out there, and so he spent a year in Nome. Most famous trial is returning the gold claim to the three Swedes who originally found gold in Nome.
Well, it sounds like you've read the book and at least some of the journals.
I have, yes.
Are there other stories that leap out at you? He was, throughout his life, a colorful character. I mean, not many people attempt to climb Mount McKinley.
Right. Well, he built their homes. He was originally from Illinois, and he had only 8 years of formal schooling. And then he taught school, and then he studied law books and passed the bar exam when he was 23 with no formal higher education. But his father had owned a lumber mill. So their first they moved, after he married Debbie, they moved to Tacoma, Washington, and he built their home there. There he climbed all the major peaks on the Olympic Peninsula. And then when they moved to Eagle, he built their log cabin there. I understand it's still there. I've not been to Eagle. And he built their home in Fairbanks, and that house is still there in Pioneer Park. So he was just the master of many trades, that he could build his homes and climb mountains and be a good judge.
Kind of a Renaissance man, really.
He really was.
So, Mary Kay, what's happening on the birthday day, which is Wednesday, up at the house? And you might give us the street address of the house for those who are listening.
213 7th Street. It's at the top of Chicken Ridge at the corner of Seward and 7th. We have two, but only two parking places out front. So if you're not here early, be prepared to walk up the stairs. We're going to serve a birthday cake at noon, and then Val Hilliard from the Juneau Garden Club is going to be here. And the Garden Club is going to plant a tree in Judge Wickersham's honor in the yard. You may remember that several years ago there were trees and they died and they were removed. So the Garden Club has offered to donate a tree, and we're going to plant that on his birthday. So there's a lot going on. We're going to be open for tours from 10 to 5, but then noon is the cake and the tree planting.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you and know that Judge Wickersham lives on in his house, at least in spirit and amongst all of those journals that he kept. And if you're interested in helping to celebrate Alaska's territorial delegate's birthday, Judge Wickersham's 159th, that will be this Wednesday. Tours at the house, which is at 213 7th Street. Tours will happen between 10 and 5. Cake cutting starts at noon. So either jump into one of those two parking spaces or plan a little time for a hike. So thanks for joining us, Mary Kay. Enjoy the cake.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. You come join us for the cake, too.
I think I will.
Okay, thank you.
This is Bird Note. True to their name, greater yellowlegs are shorebirds with bright yellow legs and feet. Ever wonder why? Perhaps it's so they can see them better. Wading in shallow water to capture small fish and insects, a yellowlegs can keep track of its legs by their bright color contrasting with the sometimes dark and irregular bottom. Keeping track of toes allows quick movements without a misstep. A sanderling, on the other hand, has black legs and feet. Running up the sandy beach in front of an advancing wave, it too is aware of every step as those black toes stand out against the pale sand. It turns out that shorebirds that forage on dark substrates, such as mudflats, usually have pale legs, while those on paler substrates, such as sand beaches, have dark legs. Mother Nature is good with the fine details. How about the brilliant orange legs of ruddy turnstones? Well, they forage just about anywhere on the shore, and those orange legs stand out like a neon light. Black-necked stilts have bright pink legs, and like yellow legs, they wade in water, where one bright color is probably as good as another. See photos of all of these birds, and get a look at those legs when you come to our website, birdnote.org. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
The Rotary Club of Juneau is proud to present the 5th Annual Capital Brewfest coming September 17th at the Jack from 1 to 5 p.m. Even more brewers from across Alaska this year, as well as great local music and food. Proceeds benefit the humanitarian works of Rotary and Juneau Stop Heroin Start Talking. Come and drink beer for a cause. Tickets are limited and this event will sell out, so buy yours at capbrewfest.com.
The Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, in partnership with KTLO, is thrilled to bring Grammy-nominated musician Madis Yahoo to Juneau on September 23rd. Expect an intimate, supercharged performance that blends reggae, beatboxing, hip-hop, singer-songwriting, and a whole lot of soul. Tickets at the Jack and Hearthside Books. Madis Yahoo in Juneau, September 23rd.
This afternoon, on a Juneau afternoon, my guests are Jesse Larson and Betsy Sims, and they will be hosting, coordinating, and teaching a workshop about marimba. All right. Is it an instrument? Is it a dance? Is it singing? Help me out here, Betsy.
Marimbas are instruments that were designed to play Zimbabwean music. We just had a wonderful Zimbabwean artist in town. A lot of people got to hear him while he was here. And these are very fun, very addictive. We brought a CD so you'll be able to hear a little bit. But anyone can play them, any level.
What is them? Describe it to me.
Have you ever seen a Western marimba?
Probably
without knowing. You play with mallets, wooden keys, and mallets.
Okay.
And a Western marimba has all 8 octaves of a piano on one instrument, and you usually play with 4 mallets. Well, the Zimbabwean marimbas are designed to be played in a group, so our instruments consist of 7 different. There's 3 sopranos, 2 tenors, a baritone, and a bass. And everyone plays a fairly simple part, but they all lock together in an incredibly fun and very addictive music that you can create with them.
When you talk about using mallets, is what you're hitting wood?
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah, so there are lots of instruments like xylophones and vibraphone, lots of things that you play with mallets. These are a really rich wooden sound. They're just stunning. The bass and the bass marimba is like 5 feet tall and 8 feet long with giant keys. They're incredibly fun to play. And what we're doing in the next starting tomorrow, we're offering several marimba classes for all levels. We have beginner kids, more advanced kids. We have beginner adults. We're also doing some with the Zimbabwean imbira, which is a kind of a thumb piano. That's also beautiful music that Jesse will be teaching. They're just really fun. We'll play you some samples so you'll know what we're talking
Great.
About. But
so, Jesse, you are a teacher as well in
yeah.
the marimba series, and this is a series,
mm-hmm.
if I'm correct about that. How
it's
long
the
will the series go on? For 4 weeks.
Yep.
Jesse, you're a young woman. How did you get into marimba? Was it as a kid? It sounds like an unusual instrument.
Yeah, so I've been playing for about 11 years. So I started when I was a kid, and I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and in Boulder there's a school, just like an after-school sort of program, kind of similar to what we're doing here. And I just started there, and then I just kind of continued and started teaching and played in bands and so that's kind of how I got into it. But it's not a very common instrument. Like, a lot of people don't really know exactly what it is, even if they've seen something similar to it. But there's little kind of pockets of Zimbabwean marimba communities all around the U.S.
It sounds like it's a large instrument, or can be a large
yeah.
instrument. How do you play it? Is it standing up, sitting down? Do you have to be a bigger person? How do you travel with it? Talk about how you manage that instrument as a player.
Well, on our set that we have in Juneau, there's two sit-down marimbas, but all of the rest of them are standing up. So the bass, you even have to stand on a bench. And so sometimes with kids, if they're especially small, they do have to stand on a bench as well. But most of the time, you can stand and play it. And then there's those two sit-down ones that two people play. But, yeah, it's a standing instrument. So you stand and you move around and you're, like, kind of having
active.
To, yeah, it's a very active instrument.
And how many people can play together at one time? Is that pretty much limitless?
As many instruments as
yeah.
you have. We have 7 instruments, but even with the 7, you can, several of the instruments, you can put more than one person on. So, and at Folk Festival, we did a workshop at Folk Festival 1 year. We had, I think, 40 people playing at once, which was too many.
Yeah, it was
too many. We had 3 people on
Jeff
all the
was laughing, too.
It was crazy. They had fun, but we were tired. But generally, it's one person per instrument. And we have a kind of a standard marimba band sizes, 3 sopranos and 2 tenors, a baritone and a bass. And that's what we have.
Talk about the parameters, then, of the workshop. Do you have some age limits and a number of enrollees limited as well, Betsy?
Yeah, we'll put as many people as there are instruments in each class. So it's very small, fun, interactive. There'll be 7 people is what we're looking for.
But
for
you
each
have
class.
A variety of classes.
Oh,
How
yeah.
many total classes will be
There'll
offered?
There'll be maximum of 4. There'll be one. There's a beginner, one for beginner kids who have never played, one for intermediate kids. Mm-hmm. Because quite a few people have played. I teach at a couple of the schools, and so some people are familiar with the marimbas here. So 2 kids' classes of 2 different levels and 2 adult classes also with 2 different levels.
Where can folks sign up for this or find more information? What's the cost, Betsy?
It's different costs for the different classes. It's about $150 per class for the 4. And then, of course, the instruments are provided.
Website information or phone call?
Not yet, but phone call.
Okay.
Let me give you my number.
You
is
bet.
Is 209-3202.
Now, you said that this will be over 4 weeks. Is it just once a week or more than once a week?
It's once a week for this series. We do all kinds of different series. We do some that are several months long. We do them at different times. So we haven't done one for a while. We've kind of all over the place for the summer. So we're back to trying to get as many new people in as possible.
What's the youngest age a player ought
Generally,
to be?
Generally, we don't start anybody any younger than 8.
Hard to get up on that bench and see anything.
Well, it's
if you're...
not bad. It's just it takes a fair amount of focus. And we have started kids younger than that, but they'll come in and meet us, and we'll decide if that's something that will work. It does take quite a bit of focus. It's great, though, because it's one of the most fun things about the marimbas is you can't do it by yourself. It's something you create with other people, so you need to listen to other people and be aware of what you're doing, which develops it's a wonderful educational tool because people start to be able to pay attention in a whole new way while having an incredible amount of fun.
Jesse, do players need physical strength?
I would say not particularly. I mean, you have to be able to move your arms, but the amount of time, super heavy, and especially like starting off, all the parts are fairly simple. Probably the most physically challenging is the bass. The keys are a lot bigger, and so the mallets are also a lot bigger, and you have to be standing on this bench. And the mallets are kind of heavy, but you're usually playing slow parts, so even that, you know, it'll only get tiring if you play it after a while. So you don't have to be, like, a strong person. I don't consider myself a, like, particularly strong person, but I can still play. So you don't have to be, like, built, but as long as you can, like, pick up your arms, you can play.
Now, you've mentioned several times Zimbabwe music. Are they used to play other types of music?
Yep. There are other things as well. You can play, and it's limited how many notes they have. It's a C. The small instruments go from a C for two octaves up to the next C, mm-hmm. with only whole notes, no sharps or flats except for one F sharp. So it's a different, it's designed specifically for that music, but lots of people write other things for them as well.
Exciting. So what time and where
there
will the workshops
probably
be?
People should just give me a shout if they want to. They're going to be Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Okay.
And then there's an Embierta class also, which still has a few spaces in it, that will be on Wednesdays.
What time?
But that'll be 5:30.
So in the evening,
yep,
then?
Yeah, all in the evenings.
It's exciting. We're talking with Jesse Larson and Betsy Sim. They will be teaching and hosting a four-week series for various learning levels, both kids and adults, on the marimbas. For more information, please call Betsy at 209-3202. And we're going to hear some of that music right now. Thank you for bringing that into our studio.
I want to throw one more thing out. Lots of people hear the marimbas and think, I could never play that. I want to just say that anyone who has any interest should come check it out, because I've worked with a lot of people who say they have no rhythm and they can't do it, and they're amazed by
how
much fun
they have. Well, it's a beautiful sound, and it sounds joyful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.